Nobody likes to deal with talking about what would happen to them if they were to pass away. It triggers a lot of emotions. And advisors typically aren't trained with how to handle those types of complex emotions.
The heart of advice. It's personal. It's pragmatic. Here on the eMoney Heart of Advice podcast, we explore how to navigate both sides to help you take your financial planning practice to the next level. Join us as we speak with financial professionals to learn how they deepen relationships and improve client outcomes. This podcast contains purely educational information, and nothing discussed may be construed as legal, tax, or financial advice. Please consult a financial advisor for any financial investment or money management questions. All views or opinions represented are solely the opinion of the speaker and do not represent those of eMoney Advisor or any of its affiliates or subsidiaries.
Welcome to the Heart of Advice podcast presented by eMoney. I'm Sasha Robinsitter.
And I'm Connor Sung. We're your eMoney experts. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Christina Lin. Dr. Christina Lin is a PhD in personal financial planning from KSU, a certified financial planner, a certified divorce financial analyst, an accredited financial counselor, and her current role is practice management consultant at Mariner Wealth Advisors. Some of her specialties include estate planning and psychology of financial planning. Christina, before we jump in, would you mind giving us a quick rundown of how you were introduced to the profession and ultimately how your journey has evolved and how you got here?
Yes, thanks for having me. Happy to be here. So I am a career changer. I got started in financial planning a little bit later than what I would have liked in life. So I decided to really focus on going back to school to get a leg up. Started in financial planning, specializing in divorce finances, bounced around from firm to firm a bit, trying to find the right fit, kept going to school, worked with some amazing mentors along the way that really helped shape my focus of my career. Now I am at Mariner and I work in advanced estate planning and training on the psychology of financial planning, and I'm a happy camper.
That's awesome. We actually, Dr. Christina, I met just like a random chance when I was looking for individuals who not only had their CFP, but their AFC. She's one of very few individuals. So, and she's also working in a firm. And so I was really excited to meet her. Probably a little overly excited, as Connor would probably know. But it was a really awesome experience. And so I'm so happy to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah, those AFC roots are pretty special.
Yes, definitely. So obviously you talked a little bit about, you know, that you have some real passion for estate planning. So according to our candid conversations, we have an estate planning guide that only 38% of planners are extremely comfortable discussing legacy planning. So I just want to ask you, why is it such a struggle for advisors and how do they overcome those obstacles so they can have their clients have updated estate plans?
Yeah, I think there's two pain points that contribute to that statistic. One is the uncertainty around estate planning. People just in general don't like uncertainty, and estate planning deals with it is just surrounded by uncertainty. Nobody likes to deal with talking about what would happen to them if they were to pass away. It triggers a lot of emotions. And advisors typically aren't trained with how to handle those types of complex emotions. Second, I think that the schooling that we receive as financial planners isn't sufficient to do a proper estate plan. And so you have to like go fish out the training or mentorship to really be able to conduct a proper estate plan review. So not having the proper training around estate planning, I shouldn't say proper, but enough to make you feel comfortable with it, doubled with the uncomfortable emotions that is triggered by clients when you talk about estate planning, I think those things contribute to why planners can be so proficient in other areas of wealth management, but maybe kind of shy away from estate planning.
I definitely agree with you there. Even from my own experience of dealing with estate plans for my parents and then other people, that conversation is a just uncomfortable one. So yeah, definitely have lots of estate planning conversations here.
Yeah. And you bring up a good opportunity, I think, there. What do you think is the gap on education? Is it like actually how to build the financial estate plan or how to have the conversation? Is it the positioning of the topic, asking the questions? Can you just fill in that hole a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I should start by saying that everything I say here is just my opinion. It doesn't represent Mariner, but I do think that it really starts with the avoidance of reading the estate plan documents themselves. My mentor, Scott Lunau, he's an estate planning attorney, and he's the one who really helped me get over the nervousness about tackling estate planning. And he's always says that you do not need to be an estate planning attorney to be able to do a good estate planning review. So just simply opening up those PDF documents and reading through them, after you do that a dozen or so times, you start to become more familiar with, okay, this is generally what these things look like. And you can start becoming pretty proficient with reviewing them. You actually don't need to go through the entire document. You're really looking for two sections that are pretty small sections. You're looking for who do they name as fiduciaries and are those appropriate and for that client. And then you're looking at what happens to you after you die. The rest is more or less boilerplate language. And so you can just skip to those sections and get really comfortable with those two things. I think that can really bridge the gap with what we're talking about.
It's super helpful. And I know we talk a lot about, or hear a lot about in the news, celebrities who didn't have an estate plan, or, you know, you hear horror stories about families. Unfortunately, my own family had some financial disruption because of lack of clarity in the estate plan. But aside from just opening the documents, are there any just important lessons that you've learned about estate planning?
Yeah, I'd say the top two important estate plan lessons that I always like to talk about are, one, the importance of creditor-predator protection. I think it really helps avoid family conflict and hurt feelings and resentment if you can plan ahead and by avoiding any of that family money from going outside the bloodline. So if you plan ahead by incorporating predator-creditor protection, you can prevent the family money from going to a new spouse if the surviving spouse remarries. Or it's pretty universal that people don't want the inheritance they leave to kids to go to an ex-spouse if their marriage doesn't work out. Of course, everyone has different opinions about that, but in general, that is a wish for people. And it's a simple solution and that you can just incorporate into your estate plan documents. So that's one I really think is important to talk about and address. The second is who you name as fiduciaries, primarily for your successor trustee. I think that in general, people think that whoever you name as successor trustee is really like a position of honor because you trust this person so much that you and respect their financial capability that you're naming them as this important role in the estate administration if you were to pass away. What the average person doesn't realize is all of the stress that comes with that position, the workload, it's a lot of administrative work, and the family conflict that can brew based on just like the very the various scenarios of how whatever family is left after you pass away, it can cause fights between siblings, aunts and uncles, step siblings. You know, every family is a little bit different, but by simply naming a corporate trustee, a professional third party that's neutral to be the successor trustee, it really just removes that potential for family discord and all of the stress that goes with being a successor trustee. So again, two really simple solutions that I think are often not given enough attention when doing estate plan reviews.
I almost imagine it's tough. I feel like most people look at their trustee as somebody that's close to the family that can deal with some of those family ties, but maybe the not foreseeing some of the stress that comes along with it. And I totally agree that, you know, getting intermediated there with a third party that can be a trusted role. Before we go on to the next section, I do want to just have you define. So I think fiduciary may be a little bit more of an expanded definition here, but as you talk about fiduciaries across the estate plan, can you just explain what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's just really a general term for who you're appointing to be in charge of your stuff or your decisions if something were to pass away if you were to pass away or become incapacitated. So I'm talking about the agent named in your powers of attorney, medical, financial powers of attorney. I'm talking about the executor of your will, personal representative. I'm talking about successor trustee in your a revocable living trust, for example, or the trustee of an irrevocable trust that you create.
I really want to roll into this next piece because I think it does kind of play in together. But you describe yourself as a behavioral finance enthusiast, which I love. I might have to like use that term now. But when it comes to discussing topics like estate planning, like how does behavioral finance come into play?
Yeah. So again, my focus in my career is really on incorporating the psychology of financial planning into all these different traditional financial planning principles. And traditional financial planning, I typically see that advisors are really good at those technical expertise areas. They're good at tax planning. They're good at investment planning. Some are good at estate planning. But there is like this mysterious side to financial planning, which is when clients don't do what we tell them to do. Sometimes they're like kind of nice to have, like, oh, you could make more money or save on tax if you do this. Other times it's like, if you don't do this, you're going to create a huge problem and you really need to do this right away for the benefit of your loved ones and yourself. But they don't do it, right? The psychology of financial planning really deals with like that side of the mysterious side of financial planning that we typically don't talk about. It's just sort of like, you know, falling through the cracks in the CRM or the, you know, note taking system, like client didn't do this sort of thing. So one of my passion projects, like I said, is really building in the psychology of financial planning into all those different areas of financial planning, the other seven domains. And the psychology of financial planning is really predicated on an advisor's emotional intelligence level. That's where it starts. If you don't have high emotional intelligence, you're not going to be able to apply psychology of financial planning techniques and exercises. And so what I often see in existing training is that leaders will tell the advisors, well, you need to work on active listening, or, you know, if you just, you know, do more reflections or ask more questions, you know, that will really be the solution. Well, I think that it's much deeper than that. It's about developing EQ skills, emotional intelligence skills. And the good news is that EQ skills is not like IQ skills, which is sort of more or less finite. You're born with, you know, a certain amount of IQ skills that, you know, no matter how much Sudoku I do, I'm not going to really you know, improve my IQ. Whereas EQ skills, there are evidence-based techniques that can improve your EQ skills. So let's focus on that to be able to utilize these psychology of financial planning principles. So yes, that's one of the areas that I'm working at Mariner is developing workshops for our advisors to go through to develop these EQ skills. And I do get some like puzzled looks. They a lot of times the response is like, okay, this is unrealistic. I wouldn't, you know, go only talk about like the softer side of communication because I need to focus on the technical stuff. Well, the problem is that all we've done so far is focus on the technical stuff and really ignored the EQ side of it. So kind of what I'm doing is over focusing on the EQ side of it for this standalone training. And then at the end, hopefully, you know, the message is that, okay, now that we have isolated these skills and worked on them in a safe environment for you to practice and receive feedback and learn some evidence-based techniques, now you can go back and put them in practice with your workflow in a financial planning meeting where you're talking about the technical side of financial planning.
I love that you're talking about emotional intelligence. Just like side plug, my colleague Chris Moriel and I have done like 3 webinars on emotional intelligence just this year at eMoney. So, you know, like we've looked at it from like just what is emotional intelligence to what is it with holistic planning. And then coming up with Summit, we have another one coming up, really focusing more on that relationship management piece. But I want to ask you about the self-awareness piece for advisors, especially when it comes to estate planning, because I'll be transparent with you as a financial professional myself. It took me 5 years after my son was born to finally put my estate plan in place. So I'm just curious, like, is it a self-awareness issue with estate planning? Is it more like just figuring out like how to really move it forward? Because it's just a scary topic in general. So,
yeah. Well, going back to the 2 points why I think more advisors are not embracing estate planning as part of their repertoire of what they're doing, I think it first starts with the self-confidence that they can effectively do this. So I do think some extra training. Personally, I learn the most from mentors. So if you can find a mentor to help you, just learn how to identify red flags and what an ideal plan might look like and what the options are to customize it based on a client's situation, that's really the starting point. And then to blend in the psychology of financial planning piece that, is, you know, being sensitive in a meeting when, you know, reading people, so much of communication is nonverbal. Like, is one of the spouses avoidant of that? Giving them the space to think about what's going on for them and then allowing them the platform to finally speak when they've had a chance to gather their thoughts. Not pushing them to action, but just trying to understand their perspective. Okay, I've made this recommendation. What's going on for you? Tell me where you're at. What are your thoughts? That sort of thing. So I don't know if that really answers your question about being self-aware, but it's definitely in the camp of developing those EQ skills.
I think you did, you know, that building of the confidence. I think it's one of the biggest pieces, and just being emotional in general, I think. So that, I think you did for sure. But speaking of mentors, I wanted to ask you about your experience with working with Dr. Rick Kaler and what learnings you kind of took away from his practice, because I do feel like he has a very unique style, especially with financial planning and his, you know, background with financial therapy. So I want to hear how that all went down. So.
Yeah, Rick is larger than life. He is such an amazing financial planner. And really an OG in the psychology of financial planning space. You go to read, a text on the psychology of financial planning, you're probably going to see his name as one of the authors. For me, what he taught me was to normalize the incorporation of financial therapy techniques and exercises into traditional financial planning. He made that just normal. Like, this is part of the intake process. This is part of annual reviews. I learned so much from him, but another highlight was that he really drove home the point that financial therapy, psychology of financial planning, expertise in that starts with doing the work yourself. You can't facilitate any of this stuff with somebody else if you haven't done this on your own first. So he really emphasized, attending classes and doing your own therapy, doing your own work, going through the exercises yourself, practicing these skills at home with your family, getting comfortable with them before doing them with a paying client. The last piece I'd say about what his work is so inspiring is he really focused on developing expertise in a modality called internal family systems, IFS. I did study that. I still use parts of that in my daily work. I chose to focus on another modality, but it's just so inspiring that here's the guy, super smart, very successful in traditional financial planning. He did not come from a mental health background, but really just embraced this this intersection between mental health and wealth management, financial planning, and found a way to ethically navigate that in bridging that gap. And that's through a lot of it is through his work with IFS.
Rick is just a pioneer in the field, to me at least, and I'll speak for myself. But, you know, speaking about that self-awareness piece, that, you know, doing the work yourself, that's really where it is and where advisors can really learn their own biases, the things that they're uncomfortable with, and just become better advisors, or as Connor says, better humans. So I'll hand it back off to Connor, though.
I had the pleasure of moderating eMoney's summit panel in 2023, and Dr. Kaler was one of the panelists for the two parts, and he definitely, I know he had an impact on me, and I took a few different things away from just speaking to him via that format. But so normalizing inclusion of these different techniques just into the financial planning process, I think is key. Starting doing it yourself, that's literally the way that we actually train most people to use eMoney as well, is build your own plan, figure out how it works, and then move on to helping other people with it. And, you know, all of these different ways of getting to understand either yourself or the technology, whatever it is, before moving forward and trying to apply those learnings to other people's situations, with the inclusion of additional personalities and additional, you know, biases and different things. We haven't talked about it yet, but you said that motivational interviewing is a really important tool for an advisor to use. Can you just give us an example of what that might sound like in practice?
Yeah. So first, what is motivational interviewing? It's an evidence-based conversation style that's proven to help clients or people move towards positive change in their life. And that can take, you know, a variety of different applications within financial planning. It might be positive change towards implementing an estate plan, or, you know, addressing an issue, a glaring issue with their investment plan, things like that. Why I'm drawn to it, one of the reasons why, is that it is not meant for only mental health professionals. It's a conversation style that can be adopted by any helping profession. So you see, You see parole officers. You see a lot of people in the medical field. You see teachers, educators, just coaches, lots of different professions that utilize this modality to make their communication sound more effective with their clients. And because a lot of pushback that I hear from financial planners when we start talking about different financial therapy techniques and exercises is they say, wait a second, I'm not a therapist. I'm a wealth advisor. Like, I don't want to be doing this sort of thing. It's outside of my comfort zone and outside of my job description. Well, on the spectrum between financial planning and financial therapy, there's this there's a middle ground that you can tap into in learning these counseling skills, these communication skills. So anyway, you didn't ask that, but I wanted to give that background why I like motivational interviewing. Hundreds of peer-reviewed studies have been published showing positive results in different fields. And I'd like to see a lot more in financial planning because I think that it has the capability of doing that. So getting to your question as for why I like an example of what motivational interviewing can do, one of the key principles that motivational interviewing addresses in one's communication style is the tendency to use the fix-it reflex. What is the fix-it reflex? It is a person's natural tendency to fix a problem when they see a problem. So if you see, like, this happens in all areas of life. It happens in parenthood with spouses. It happens in financial planning a lot because we are trained to spot issues. We can see them as soon as you look at a net worth statement or as soon as you see them when you look at a beneficiary designation. And they're paying for our advice. So it's very natural for advisors to respond very quickly in conversations to present solutions when they identify a problem. They're like 40 steps ahead of the client who's solving for problems that the client doesn't even know is a problem yet. And so bringing in that fix-it reflex is one of the key principles of motivational interviewing. It teaches the interviewer or the advisor in this situation to just slow down and be more curious about understanding the client's perspective, employing accurate empathy, and what they call rolling with resistance. When a client says something that's clearly against traditional financial planning advice, instead of pointing it out right away, you just kind of roll with it. Like, you don't, in order to do your job really well, you don't need to abruptly correct a person. You can let them explore it and get curious about it. Eventually, you'll have the right opportunity to give information and give advice, but just not come in too quickly to resolve problems. It was one example of how motivational interviewing is a helpful communication style.
I definitely do that in my own personal life, and I know it doesn't work very well for me there. So I can imagine it's definitely an easy win as you think about going through an initial discovery or even, you know, a rediscovery at some points where people bring up some stuff that they may have forgotten about. And, you know, you want to jump on top of them and ask why or start to fix it. But it's good stuff.
Yeah, I definitely practice it at home. Like, this is a skill that constantly needs to be developed and sharpened. I mean, you think you get somewhere and then you go home and totally stick your foot in your mouth. But yes, it's a journey we're all on.
I just want to ask you about the power of questions for a minute, because I think that you're the one to ask about this, especially when it comes to like these complicated topics. Motivational interviewing, as you said, like, there's hundreds of studies of, you know, the success of it. But I think at the heart of it, I just want to hear, like, what are like a few questions like you're like, hey, the advisors, these like two questions, these are the best ones to ask. I'd love to hear that.
Actually, this is a little bit surprising, but according to the motivational interviewing style, you should ask, you should use 2x reflections as you do 2 questions. So there's actually more emphasis on utilizing reflection. So rather than when we're talking and you say something to me, I then rather than respond with a question, even if it's a really good open-ended question, I respond to whatever you say with a statement that ends with my voice dropping rather than my voice elevating. So so when you're saying something, it's the tip of the iceberg. And so I'll then respond with a reflection with my best guess as to what's going on below the surface. So that is a good use of a reflection. So it's not really an answer to your question, but it's a really good opportunity to bring up how reflections are actually way underutilized by financial advisors. We always just default to the question, like, what are the good questions? Absolutely. There's a lot of good questions. I know like Megan Lertz has a list of really great questions on her Kitsis website, and lots of people are good at those. What I would like to see is us get better at using reflections, because when you're asked a question, sometimes subconsciously it can trigger defensiveness. But if I respond to you with a reflection, it's sort of an unsaid acceptance of whatever you say. Even if it's not, I don't agree with it, I'm making you feel comfortable with your position, and I'm inviting you to say more about it, to correct me, to add on top of it. And that makes for a really great financial planning conversation.
On that note, so you obviously have done quite a bit. I know we talked about at the very beginning that you decided to use education to try and get a leg up for your somewhat later start to the industry. But as you think about financial professionals trying to get better at what they're doing, what resources, books, people, recommendations you have for financial professionals that are looking to get more information as it pertains to the psychology of financial planning?
Yeah, so it's expensive, but the CFP Board's Psychology of Financial Planning book that was published just 2 years ago, 2022, is really good. It has chapters by different authors, and all the authors are the OGs in the financial psychology space. So not only can you hear a little bit or read a little bit about what their take on the psychology of financial planning is, you can also like start following those people: Dr. Sonia Luter, Rick Kaler, Dr. Megan McCoy, Dr. Emily Kuchel, things like that. People like that. That's a really great resource to get you kickstarted into this space. Also, if anybody's interested in learning more about motivational interviewing, really great resource is the book. That one is inexpensive. It's written by the founders of motivational interviewing, Dr. Bill Miller and Stephen Rolnick. And it walks through all the principles, and you can then take courses on, you can get training, live training on it too. And then lastly, I think a really good kind of consumer-facing book is The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel.
It's a great book. That, and I would say track down Dr. Christina Lin, and she'll be able to help you out too.
Yes, definitely. We just have one final question for you, Christina. Is lastly, how would you define the heart of advice when it comes to financial planning?
Yeah, so I think it goes back to what I was talking about with the traditional financial planning and the mysterious backside of the traditional financial planning. Like, what's going on under the surface for your clients? Be really endlessly curious about what's going on for them, and make it your mission to really understand their perspective without any ulterior motive. I think that ultimately you're going to give really great advice because you're trained on the technical expertise side of things to do that. You know how to use e-money well, for example. Those are all really great tools. Now what we need to do is build out the other side by really connecting with our clients, building that human connection, which starts with building your EQ skills.
Well, Dr. Lynn, I've had a wonderful chat with you. All these things made me so happy to talk about emotional intelligence, motivational interviewing, estate planning, all these things that I love, and I'm glad that our listeners could hear it from you as well.
Thank you so much, Sasha and Connor. It was a pleasure to be here with you.
It was a great time. Thank you.
The Heart of Advice podcast is produced by eMoney Advisor, a leading provider of technology solutions and services that help people talk about money. Learn more at eMoneyAdvisor.com, where you can find additional resources for advisor success, including the Heart of Advice blog, as well as eBooks, CE webinars, and events.
This podcast is provided for informational and educational purposes only. Any opinions expressed herein are subject to change without notice. Mariner is the marketing name for the financial services businesses of Mariner Wealth Advisors, LLC, and its subsidiaries. Investment advisory services are provided through the brands Mariner Wealth, Mariner Independent, Mariner Institutional, Mariner Ultra, and Mariner Workplace, each of which is a business name of the registered investment advisory entities of Mariner. For additional information about each of the registered investment advisory entities of Mariner, including fees and services, please contact Mariner or refer to each entity's Form ADV Part 2A, which is available on the Investment Advisor Public Disclosure website. Registration of an investment advisor does not imply a certain level of skill or training.